Liminalist, horticulture.com. Between the podcast, Jason Horsley, I am talking to Francis Hutchins. I am, actually. Hi, I'm okay. It's kind of a bit discombobulated today. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm a bit nervous.
Yeah, you mentioned that possibility. That's all right.
Feels like some kind of job interview or something.
Yeah, well, it's not. We just have a conversation, and if we both feel it would make a good podcast, then it will, and if not, it's just a conversation.
It's kind of strange just speak to someone you've never met.
Yeah.
Conversation. But you feel like you know them.
Right. Well, that part. I was going to say it's not strange for me because I do it every week. But the part about the feeling of knowing someone, I don't necessarily have that. And with yourself, a little bit. I mean, we've corresponded by email for some time, and you do have some stuff you put out there. You have an internet presence. And of course, I know stuff about your past because it was so dramatic.
Yeah. I try not to have too much of an internet presence because the mean, bad world of social media, you know yourself how addictive it can be to get drawn into that world.
Yeah. So what? It's basically I didn't catch up at the last minute because we were going to talk a while ago and then we didn't and now we are, and so it's been a while since I actually looked at your web presence. So what does it consist of, and does it involve offering some sort of service? I think I noticed something along those lines.
Yeah, well, I did my website for my sex contract, I think about 4 years ago, to document them. And I thought, I'm going to put them in one place, which I'm really glad about now because I can then...
You better tell us, if this is a podcast, you better say what a sex contract is, otherwise it's going to sound very weird.
So I designed or wrote 5 sex contracts, and I wrote them as legal documents. A friend who was a solicitor helped me to write them. So I had a lot of research that I did because I was looking at the women's role in marriage, the idea of a marriage contract, the idea of the written and the spoken word. And it was all this completely disparate, disconnected research that came together. So I thought I'd just write an essay explaining it because it always seems kind of a bit titillating, a little bit silly. Which it is in one level, but on another level, it was quite an interesting project I set myself just to start to understand the nature of the difference between writing and speaking and how our culture is so underpinned by contractual relations in everyday life.
So what was roughly the content of the sex contract?
Well, I did 5 different contracts. So I did one which would be if you wanted to sleep with someone for the first time. And then I did another one if you wanted to have a liaison or an affair. And I did another one is if you want to formalize a relationship. And I did another one if you want to have multiple partners or a threesome. And then the other one was if you want to prostitute yourself, you want to sell your sexual favors to people. And I thought it was a kind of play on that notion of the marriage contract, really, and thinking, well, people are willing to sign a marriage contract, but how far back would they go? Like, how would it be better if we could be on the same page and talk about those things?
Right. So, and of course, writing, turning into contract is literalizing it to an extreme and actually legalizing it. As compared to just being very clear about what's understood. I mean, for example, when you see in movies a lot where a couple, a young couple, I mean, kids say, are we dating now? Like, there's this, at what point does a friendship become a courtship, for example? That's something that's very unclear, that's clear that it's unclear, right? Partly because of the discomfort about just being upfront about one's intentions and one's desires.
And also, it stemmed from a personal point of view. My friend had said that she had a lover, and yet it seemed like she wanted a relationship, but he liked to use the term lover. And I thought it was interesting because, they just simply weren't on the same page. But it got me thinking, well, we use these words and we think we know what a boyfriend and a girlfriend are and a relationship is, but it's actually only our definition that we understand. And so, yeah.
And of course, they're changing so rapidly as well in terms of what the superficially agreed on definition is, anyway, or what the roles are of boyfriend, girlfriend, or partner, or husband, or wife, and so on.
But you also say agreed on, and that's only if you agree, isn't it? Because often people don't even get to that point of agreeing on anything. It just kind of happens. And then somebody might just be in a, just want a fling, and somebody else might be in it for the long haul, and you've got that initial tension already.
Yeah, and of course, there's so much deception in that field, as every other field, but perhaps more than most, in terms of the sexual game, whatever we're going to call it, the sexual courtship field, looking for sex field, the tendency to deceive in order to get what you want, which is the only reason anyone would ever deceive, I suppose, is quite strong. And so then the temptation, even to unconsciously take advantage of the lack of clarity in terms of what we're committing to, or what we think the other thinks we're committing to, and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah, in the sense that maybe in the 1950s there was a gravity associated with entering into a sexual relationship, and there were implications, and now you can have a one night stand and you get pregnant, you know that. So the yeah, I think people just they don't even enter into it consciously often. I mean, sometimes they do, but what I found interesting was, in a sense, I feel that becoming a couple is almost an implied contract, and that's what I found quite funny, that even though you may not say explicitly what your expectations are, there's still a contractual arrangement. But if you were to put it into writing, people get very uncomfortable. So again, it was that notion of why is it different if you write it down or if you sign something, to just agreeing and having a conversation about it.
Right. And what's your answer to that?
Don't know really, to be honest. I don't know. There's something kind of about writing that makes it permanent, isn't there? That
Yeah.
I guess people could be held accountable. Whereas,
It formalizes it, yeah. It fixes it, but it also, I could say sterilizes it or literalizes it, or there's lots of isises we could use there probably, but it de-romanticizes it as well, I think.
which again, I find quite funny because the peak of romantic love supposedly is marriage or a wedding, but isn't that just contract signing
Yeah.
of the marriage register?
Yeah, well, this may be off track, or it may not be. When you say the peak of romantic love, it's actually contradictory, because I thought you were going to say something about the troubadours and how they wrote songs and poems and stuff. Because that's really interesting, because the peak of romantic love, literally, historically, was that period, and it had nothing to do with sex or marriage.
No, absolutely not. And that's where you have like Tristan and Isolde, and of course Romeo and Juliet, I think, are the best example of that romantic love. and the kind of ridiculousness of it, of wanting that in your everyday life. It's just not possible to have that unconsummated, insane desire, is it? And reconcile that with a day-to-day, functioning, healthy relationship.
No, but nor would it be a very satisfying experience if you could have it, right? So what we want is the immense longing and the gratification of it that doesn't somehow reduce the longing, which is, of course, marriage has proven so distressingly and disillusioningly impossible, right, to do that.
See, one of the things that I started to look at, because I am very interested, like you, in alternative history, consensus reality, those kind of things, was how much our sense of romantic love or love in itself is defined by Hollywood. And I think it has a huge influence over how people perceive it, and television as well.
And pop music, probably even more.
Yeah. So I think it feeds that sense of what love is, and yeah, if you're not suffering, then there's something missing, you know. There has to be drama in your relationship.
Yeah.
One of my favorite phrases actually was in a book, and I'm not very very good at remembering quotes, but it really stuck with me, and they were talking about a happy home and domesticity, and it was, contentment remains unsung. I like that.
Right. Yes, because it doesn't really make for good drama. It's the last line of the fairy tale, of course.
You never see it, though, do you? In the fairy tale, it just ends at that moment of the lovers getting together. Or not, or dying.
Yeah, well, they lived happily ever after is the line I'm referring to, right? So everything after is not included because it's not dramatic. It's just they lived happily ever after. Yeah.
That's hard. That's the hard bit, though, isn't it?
Yes. Well, of course, ever after is a very long time. So, I mean, what's circling around my awareness, my personal awareness of marriage, obviously, but in terms of how... a major part of it has been disillusionment, has been the busting and the dissolving of the romantic illusion that we had on meeting. Even though we were both quite mature, we were both in our 40s, I just turned 40 or 41, and we saw the marriage as it was beginning in this very abstract way before we'd met as an alchemical thing. That was the language we used in those days, which had to do with the annihilation of the ego and of one's personal desires, and that sort of Jungian, you know, what's it called, of the opposites, the conjunction of the opposites, that idea, that very spiritual idea. But of course we romanticized that too, and so that also got destroyed in the process, or came out in the wash, or what have you. But at not on the end of it, but at this point where I'm at now, I can see that we were right about the illusion of the romantic idea and all of that. We'd got that right, and we were kind of right about the alchemical process, just that we couldn't help but romanticize it. So I'm not sure I'm really going with that. And we did do contracts, like we wrote our own contracts. And one of the things I did in contract, never spoken about as public, it's not, I don't know how private it is, but it probably interests you in terms of what you're exploring with these contracts, is that we wrote, in our vows, we wrote all of the worst things in there too, all the things we didn't want to do to other, we vowed to do those things. Like I vow to take out my anger on you irrationally, and I vow to take you for granted, and I vow to get sick of you, and I vow to, you know, just all the dark stuff. We put that in the vows too, because we knew we were going to do it, so why not formalize it, right?
How do you feel that marriage has changed your relationship? And do you think that had you not got married, you would have still gone as deep and experienced as much together?
Well, the context for our getting married was we did a marriage ceremony soon after we met physically, that was our own informal thing. Like it was just us and was our own invention, right? So it didn't have any legal meaning or anything, and there weren't any contracts involved, although there was a ceremony. And then a year later we got legally married, and the main reason I think was because I wanted to move to Canada, and so there was a practical reason to do it. So I don't think that it made that much difference, actually, really. I mean, there was a certain superficial element of, let's formalise this in a way of, if it's actually legally binding, that is an expression of trust. So I think that was significant in itself. But I don't think it was, I'd say it was about 10 or 20% tops in terms of the whole commitment that we were making.
I find it interesting that people need that contract, that marriage, they need that contract sometimes to prove something to them, that it's not enough to be together. That's what I find interesting, because it's not like before, where women, it benefited women economically, or it simply was the done thing to get married. I could understand then why you would get married, but I'm curious now why young people still feel the need to get married. And I can only assume that it does have there's a powerful archetype there, that for some reason people are drawn to.
Well, George Harrison's wife apparently was asked the secret of the longevity of her marriage to George. I don't know if you heard this anecdote. Said, what's the secret of staying married as long as you did? And she said, not getting divorced. And that to me is the meaning of the contract, and this is very unromantic and very unpopular now, so I agree, I don't know why people get married now, because there's no way they would accept what I'm about to say, which is that the marriage contract is to commit to be together no matter what, no matter how bad it gets, regardless of what you want. And that's been, needless to say, super, super hard for me. There's been so many times where I've just said, no, fuck this. I'm not getting what I need. I'm not getting what I want.
My friend is a legal secretary, and it's, February now, and it's been the busiest time of year for divorces. I think it kicks in right around Christmas. And she was saying how there's something really nasty about divorces. Like, it brings out these emotions in people, and I was talking to her recently, and I was saying how strange it is to think these people have obviously at some point loved each other or respected each other enough to get married and build a life together, and it can disintegrate into this mudslinging. And I find that quite terrifying, really.
Have you been married?
No. I have no intention of getting married. Apart from, like you, if it was a visa thing. Yeah. It's a practical reason. Or if the government suddenly said, you get a 50% tax cut. But there's no, as far as I understand, there's no economical reasons in England to get married. I don't think there's any benefits. I think if it's being a single mom, you get more benefits that way, but it doesn't promote the family. But I guess that's another conversation.
And of course I'm aware of your history and what point to bring it up, because it's obviously so profoundly significant to your feelings about marriage.
My mum's never married, so I don't know.
She wasn't married to your dad?
No.
Oh, okay. No. So then in a way that doesn't, I mean, obviously it does, but it doesn't. I mean, this is the thing, like the institution of marriage has to be secondary to the reality of two people staying together for a lifetime. and whatever that allows to happen, let's say.
What is it about people wanting these big weddings, though? And I can't, sometimes I think, is there some correlation between the bigger the wedding, the more likely
they are to split? Yeah, yeah. It would make sense, wouldn't it, psychologically, because you're compensating for the doubt by putting on a big show.
I mean, the average cost is about £20,000.
I find weddings appalling. I mean, I would never go to a wedding unless I had to. I would go to funerals. I think funerals have meaning. Weddings, I think, is just crazy because of this, that it's not what we think it is. Marriage is simply not what we think it is. So I'm bringing it back to what you were addressing there with the acrimony of divorce. That's certainly something that I've experienced in terms of the acrimony. And I wrote about it a long time ago. I think I called it the culture, marriage and the culture of blame, or something like that. And it was about, from self-observation, being married for a couple, well, what was it? It was only 2 years. Actually, things started getting worse after we actually got legally married, but I think that was just to do with the timing of it. But anyway, what I noticed was, I became more and more aware of, was how, as the feelings of hope and of desire and of happiness of finding this person turned into disappointment and frustration, they generated corresponding blame, like the unconscious tendency to blame the other for failing to meet the needs that they had awoken in one.
I'm wondering as well if there's a desire for certainty that maybe people feel like having a wedding, getting married, will provide some kind of guarantee and a certainty, which we know cannot exist in life. We know that we can't be certain of anything
except death. Yeah,
death and taxes. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
A sense of striving to make something solid.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure. I haven't thought about that before.
Well, I mean, when somebody gets married, I mean, it's obviously different for men and women. I mean, there's this great irony, which is a source of, I guess you could say, black humour or bitter humour in the West, which is that guys get married so that they'll be able to have sex. and then they find out that actually you don't get to have sex in marriage after a designated time. That's it. There's no more sex, kind of thing. It doesn't have to be that extreme, of course. But so, and for a woman, it's obviously something different. But in the broadest terms, we think that getting married means we are guaranteed happiness. The happiness of being with another and having that hole filled, so to speak, figuratively, the male case. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard for me to understand, purely because I've never believed in the institution. And I think it is an institution, and we should examine all institutions, because they're not often there for our own benefit. And marriage certainly hasn't been something that historically has benefited women. So again, it's something that I would rather not be part of.
As an institution.
Yeah, yeah.
As compared to being with a man and having children and staying with that man.
From the research I've done, it seemed to be that a lot of women, I think it was ancient China, the prostitutes were often the women that could be educated, and so they were obviously the women that were married were kept in the home and often illiterate. So I don't really believe that marriage has benefited women at all.
Well, there's an assumption there that education is beneficent.
Yeah, there is an assumption, yeah,
which is quite a broad one considering what we've uncovered about education.
I don't want to say equal to men, but I don't know. I'm trying to put myself in the position of a ancient Chinese woman and imagining maybe she could actually have a half decent conversation with a man, whereas maybe the man just came home to the woman and the woman's function was a domestic function.
Well, I think we're getting to the quick of, you know, what is of benefit to a human organism in the first place, and what marriage or togetherness with a man or whatever we're going to call it, I mean with another, might provide that would be of benefit, but that we might not recognize as beneficent, right? So this was the thing that my wife and I tried to be conscious of as we entered into it, that what we're entering into is a contract or a commitment to something greater than either of us.
Yeah, because if it's just an exchange, you know, like a sugar daddy or marrying someone for their money or marrying someone because they want children, then maybe it's doomed to fail. You're basing it on those fragile foundations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the archetypal meaning of marriage or the archetypal promise of marriage is something eternal.
But we're not eternal.
Well, that depends.
Not in this form, we're not.
Yeah, no, we're not physically eternal. So then you have the notion that the conjunction of opposites is a union of souls that can continue beyond the existence of the bodies. So it would be till death do us unite rather than death do us part, if we've been able to console ourselves or align ourselves in this shared experience of what I'm really reluctant to put a name on now, because all these names and words have been romanticized, surrender to that which is greater or that which is eternal, and that marriage can be, but I think is maybe one of the only environments experiences that will allow for that potentially, because it's, I mean, having a child would be another big one. It's so the experience of having one's own desires eroded away while at the same time being inflamed is so profound, right? Like being in a relationship where one is constantly being reminded of what one didn't get as a child, what one emotionally needs, while at the same time not being able to get it, because it's that person can't heal that wound.
It could also be simply that our lives now, often, I said our lives, generally speaking, the workers, are pretty terribly mundane, and marriage and children and are these milestones, something to look forward to, something to transcend the boring, banal, daily grind of everyday life and give us a reason to celebrate something. I think that certainly people do invest a lot in what is essentially just one day when it comes to the wedding.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the inverse of what I was trying to express, isn't it? The purely temporal, the momentary high, as opposed to the eternal, whatever that is. I mean, we can't even conceive of something that would be eternal, except in negative terms, I think, which is letting go of all of our identifications with the temporal. And the sex drive is the strongest one we have. So, I mean, how I saw marriage before, during, and I can't say after, but it's kind of after in a way that I feel like I've come through the worst of it, touch wood, was as a crucible, as in you get in the pot and the heat just keeps rising and you try not to get out.
I did used to believe that it was that a relationship was two half people making a whole, like, which is a kind of romantic thing, isn't it, to find somebody to complete you.
Yeah.
And I think now that I definitely believe that not to be the case, and actually two half people are often two people that aren't particularly well functioning, and that it's good to be a whole person, meeting a whole person. And it's not as romantic, but when you put those two things into a crucible, then magic can happen.
Yeah, well, I don't think anyone's whole, though. So it's more about how meeting another fragmented person and getting in the pot together is going to intensify our awareness of our own lack of wholeness, because we think that we can use this other one to fill us, and we'll find frustration after frustration, which keeps intensifying our sense of how we're not whole. And that awareness, I think, can heal. So I think two people can become whole together, not by completing each other, but just by reflecting each other.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that isn't talked about enough. And it really was only me doing these investigations into the nature of language and the place of marriage within the society that helped me realize where romantic love came from. I always thought it had been there forever, like some kind of timeless thing. It never occurred to me that it was actually a cultural construct. And so if you don't look back at everything and start questioning everything and every institution and every belief that you have, they can easily be formed and you can become misinformed. So, but actually my partner now, I entered into a sex contract with him. So we didn't actually have any romantic dating period of time. And it's worked out really well.
So what about a friendship period of time?
We were friends for about 2 or 3 months, and I said to him, do you want to sign a sex contract? And he said, no, I'm happy being friends. I don't want to spoil our friendship. And then went home and realised he was being an idiot because he realised he'd just turned down the opportunity for sex. And why did he do that?
Yeah.
And so then, yeah, we signed the sex contract and I was really nervous. I was thinking, okay, because everybody has always asked me, have you signed a sex contract? You made the contracts up. And I thought, okay, I'm going to do it this time. So yeah, that was a really interesting experience to enter into a relationship on that basis without any of that expectation of romance, of ideas about the future. We had agreed to have 3 mergers, which is what I call them in my contract, and then after that we discuss it further.
Mm.
And then it just seemed to continue. So that was 1.5 years ago.
So you mean you didn't sign new contracts after the first?
We were going to sign one to have a liaison, but then we didn't, and we decided we didn't need a contract, which is interesting, isn't it? We started our relationship with a contract and we talked it through, and then we realized that we wanted it to progress and unfold naturally without constraints.
Right. So what difference did having that contract make, do you think?
It allowed us to confront certain things that I think you wouldn't necessarily talk about, and to be clear. And that is something I feel that is really difficult for romance, and this whole industry of dating, you know, what to do on the first date, what you should do by the third date, if he hasn't proposed to you by the fifth date, there's a kind of sense of, I don't know, just this is how it should be, and by both of us saying, well, this is how it is, we're just going to talk about it, and okay, we're going to agree to use a condom, we're going to agree to have an abortion if I get pregnant, and these really boring important pieces of information, and it's only going to last 3 times, we're only going to have sex 3 times, and then we can discuss it further. It felt like, oh okay, I felt completely liberated in a way from that whole weight of romantic behavior. It was like a friendship, I think, and that is really the key basis of a good relationship to me now. The first time.
Yeah, well, it's one of these unasked questions, really, is what is the difference between a friendship with sex and a romance? You know, what is this extra element that supposedly comes into play when two people say they're in love as compared to that they're good friends who have sex? Well, I mean, of course, there could be a person can say they know an emotional difference, but that's very subjective. But just in terms of, you know, what's this mysterious element that enters into it that makes it somehow more than just an agreement to have sex?
Yeah, we had that situation for about 4 or 5 months. So we didn't sign another contract, but then we weren't referring to each other as boyfriend and girlfriend. But we'd spend every weekend together. And then there came a point where I think it's really hard to define, isn't it? You just like spending time with each other and you feel good and you want to build a life together. But it sounds really cheesy though. This is the thing, sometimes there's no real words, is there, really, to describe.
Well, there is that word that people don't like so much anymore, which is commitment.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you're feeling committed to something. Now, I mean, there's a whole trope about how biology tricks us into having sex by making it so pleasurable. You say, well, the same thing as falling in love is a trick of the chemistry to you know, get us to start a family with this person, because human beings have learned that they can just have sex without doing that, right? So then how can you get them to start a family? Oh, well, let's make them think they're falling in love. But the commitment isn't necessary to that, actually, is the thing. Like, well, the feeling of meeting somebody and that it sparks or it brings into awareness a new sense of purpose, perhaps, is what I'm trying to get at. And the woman wants to commit to that renewed sense of purpose without necessarily knowing what it is. Like you said, build a life together. Well, I mean, that could be very mundane and very, well, not necessarily dull, but just very practical. But it sounds as though you're also talking about something that isn't just mundane and practical there, some deep feeling that you're entering into some process with this person.
Yeah, and life's just better with that person. And I think that it's actually really simple. It can be really simple, can't it? You just enjoy each other's company. And I was quite scared about the mundane aspects of, because to me, they weren't romantic. So to me, it took a long time to appreciate the small things and the everyday, which is actually life, isn't it? It's the small things that we look back on, and they're fun, and we enjoy them, and we still enjoy them. And yeah, it's like kind of creating your own world together, and yeah, it's like a bubble, isn't it?
Well,
Interesting.
that's the folie à deux thing. That's very tempting. How long have you been together?
A year and a half.
So you are still in the bubble period, if we can call it that, the honeymoon, right?
Begin though for the first 5 months, so we didn't have a bubble initially.
Because you were just friends, you mean?
Yeah, because we were very unsure about it, so I think I was definitely on erred on the side of, well, this is clearly going to fail, because of everything stacked against us. So I was actually pleasantly surprised. I'm very cynical by nature as well, so it's quite strange for me to talk about being in a bubble and all these positive things.
Yeah, well,
But
you're, I
I'm
mean,
ready for the shit to hit the fan.
yeah, well, they say, cynics are always just disappointed romantics. So it doesn't necessarily undo the cultural programming of romanticism, disappointment. Like I use the word disillusionment because that's closer to the what does undo the programming is the dispelling of illusions. But it's the same word in Spanish, disappointment, disillusionment, and it's the same emotional experience pretty much. You have a hope, you have a dream, and reality just crushes it or erodes it away over time. And then you're left with reality, which is well, it has the particular quality of being real.
I don't, as yeah, it's difficult to define reality though, isn't it? I mean, do you mean like a day-to-day existence or fundamental reality?
Yeah, well, okay, so it's an ongoing process, so I wouldn't want to try and define reality, but we can at least define our experience of getting close to it by what we've discovered it's not, right? What the things we've discovered are not real. I mean, this is my life in a nutshell, really, and what I do so much online is the netty netty. Okay, I thought that was real, nope, I thought this was real, nope, and just going through it. So is it the mundane? No, not really. I mean, it is, it's accepting, it has to do with accepting the mundane for sure. And that I suppose our tendency to romanticize things, to spin a fairy tale out of stuff that is really either just practical and pragmatic and biological, or it's neurotic, right? As in when two people come together, like there's a combination of neurotic needs with practical, biologically hardwired drives. But then I think there's, and so getting close to reality would be separating those out and identifying those and de-romanticizing those. But then there's this thing that we're both circling around, which is the thing that is neither neurotic nor pragmatic in the normal sense, that is really deeply, deeply meaningful and that does relate to love. It's not, I mean, love is, well, don't know what we can say about love, but it doesn't seem to be just part of biology, let's put it that way.
No, it doesn't feel like it's particularly necessary for the other outcomes,
mm-hmm.
be they children or any of that kind of stuff. But I do wonder if intention is a good word to put into the mix. But the intention of being with someone, the intention of allowing them to grow and growing yourself. And
that's,
it's always in motion.
It's what?
It's always in motion. I think that the idea for me of marriage is there's a kind of setting of something, a concrete. Whereas I like that idea of flow, that things don't always harmonize between you, but there's an intention to connect, even when it's sometimes difficult, and to keep moving and evolving, hopefully.
Mm. So that's what I was calling commitment.
And I like the word intention. Commitment sounds, again, a bit too much like marriage to me.
Yeah, I don't like the word intention. You know why?
We come back to the idea of words, don't we? We come back to this idea of your definition of commitment is different to mine, and we're using the same language, but we're not.
Yeah, well, I think part of the reason I like the word commitment is that I don't like it. You know, so it seems more realistic. Like, oh God, how boring, commitment. But, you know, so it's not, I can't really get excited about it.
What we're talking about is exactly the point in a web, why I looked into language, because we are speaking the same language, but we're not. And it's hard sometimes, isn't it, to use words to communicate accurately what we're trying to convey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when you're talking about that between two people building a life, it can be difficult.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, maybe that's to do with what we're talking about as well in terms of the commitment, because one of the things that I, or the intention, one of the things I definitely, one of the ways I could describe the experience of being married was the necessity of dropping beneath surfaces, so that would include words. Like, I had this preconceived notion of what being loved would look and feel like, and being treasured and being valued, and that was, of course, what I was expecting entering into a long-term or lifelong relationship, was I would get that thing that I wanted, which is the feeling of being treasured. And but I had to recognize over time, because this is also a male-female thing, but I think language relates to that too, like image versus language, say, that has the male-female qualities to it too. The way that my partner, my wife, communicated her appreciation of me was difficult for me to recognize. Like, it was, she loved in a different language.
I was going to say from Venus.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a good book, that Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. I should get paid commission for the amount of times I recommend that book.
Did you just mention that to me in an email? Because somebody did. Oh, it was in your form response. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I was reluctant to read that book purely because often popular books are just really bad and cheesy, but I brought myself to read it at the end of my last relationship, and I thought, okay, right, this is why this relationship failed, because I purely hadn't understood that men's needs and women's needs were different, and it took me so long to realize that, because words aren't enough sometimes, are they? We can't even necessarily verbalize what we need. It's hard to put into words.
No, yeah.
So yeah. But me and my boyfriend, we do a lot of physical activity together, and I think that's a good way to communicate and connect. It's not only words. I think sometimes we can get bogged down with just being together through language.
Absolutely, of course. But I was what I was trying to describe a moment ago, so it's even like being together doesn't even depend on being together in any observable way at all. Like not even being in the same room, not even emotionally connecting, not verbally connecting, not mentally connecting, not physically connecting. There can still be a deeply committed or a deeply intended connection there that is developing and deepening through the removal of those surface things. That's been my experience. That I got to a place where there was nothing visible or experiential in the relationship. It just seemed like it was dead. There was nothing there, but it turned out there was. I couldn't tune into it.
Winter, you know.
Yeah, that's right. In the winter, it seems like everything's dead, but it's not true. It's just deep under the earth.
Yeah, I think there's a kind of cyclical element to relationships, to everything, isn't there? Seasonal, and often we do expect it to be consistent.
Springtime, yeah,
Yeah.
every day,
And of that sense of abundance. And I like that idea of expanding and contracting, that sometimes you have to be apart, even if it's just in your mind, to come back together again. That, yeah, there's again, it's that idea that we always try to make things the same and consistent and certain, and it's not how nature works. You know, it's kind of good to put a forest fire in the mix occasionally.
Well,
It's
that's the
important, isn't it? It has a purpose.
well, the raising of the land, now that you burn the fields so that you can sow the crops the next year or the year after. That's a sort of human interacting with nature thing that I think seems to apply in my life too, that there are periods where I just burn the whole terrain, not consciously, but it happens, and then I realize that it's happened, and it seems like everything has just been razed, everything's just been blasted to nothing, and then there's a period of destitution, but within which something new is coming into form. And so, I mean, through the process,
Can only be allowed to come into form through that previous experience of expulsion, or I don't want to say desecration, but yeah, destruction. I used to be really into anarchism and nihilism and these existentialism when I was younger, and I read a lot about the anarchists in France and that kind of period of time. And there was a quote by one of the anarchists, which I used to love, which was, "The urge to destroy is also a creative urge."
Yeah, I remember that one.
Restaurant, I order
not sure I agree with it, but I mean, it does relate to what we're saying. But I think that this is a compulsive thing that tries to self-sabotage, and I certainly did that throughout my life. And it did work, I suppose, but because it was compulsive, it was kind of anti-nature as well. Like, it just seems as though there's a difference between letting things fall apart and actually tearing them down.
Yeah. Like you say, that we like to control things, but sometimes we don't necessarily know when it is the right time to do something or to not do something. We try and instigate something and it's not the right time because it's winter or it's summer.
Yeah, if we're out of tune with the cycles, then yeah.
Can't plant spring bulbs in spring because it's the wrong time. Nothing's going to happen, is it?
Yeah, well, you'll get frustrated is the thing that will happen.
But I kind of feel a little bit like, oh my God, I've come onto your podcast and I'm a woman and I'm talking about relationships.
Funny, huh?
Like a cliche.
Well, it's an interesting time for the podcast because I don't know if you've noticed, or if it's the kind of thing that you would notice as a woman or not, but I haven't spoken to women for ages. It's been like 30 podcasts or something without speaking to a woman. And then as today, Alison Miller went up, and that's the first, and like I've got 5 podcasts now, I think, including with you, you know, backed up, and they're all with women. So suddenly I'm talking to women now. There's no obvious reason for this. I could extrapolate, I could deduce from things that have been going on in my life, but there's certainly no external reason. I didn't decide, oh, I'm going to speak to more women, because I don't do that. I just think it's counterproductive. I mean, part of me wants to, like, oh no, I haven't spoken to a woman, but I just inhibit that. It's back to what we were just saying. I don't want to have to try and direct it, because when the time's right, the time's right. So apparently the time is right, is the point. I just spoke to Holly on Thursday, and so it seems fitting that we would be talking about, well, whatever. I mean, they're traditionally female concerns, I guess, but even just talking about marriage, I mean, it's something I should be doing with a woman, not with a man, because otherwise it'd be very one-sided. Obviously we would just complain.
I was reading the Daily Mail, which is one of my indulgences, and they had a thread of a Reddit thread, because the Daily Mail seems to basically be made up of Reddit threads now.
Really? That's bizarre.
It's cheap journalism, isn't it? Reddit threads and other apps and Whisper app and various things. And it was about what men don't understand about women, and I thought it was quite entertaining.
Mm.
About how women could just talk all the time, go out and talk about people, go and buy shoes, complain about wearing high heels all day, come back. And I just thought it just made me laugh. It just reminded me of that. Yeah, men talking about marriage, what that would have entailed.
Mm-hmm.
He's always complaining it's not tidy enough.
Wait, she is in the cliche? Was it she that's complaining about the tidiness?
It is, isn't it?
Because it's the opposite. I mean, whatever, I don't want to, because it's the cliches, one shouldn't refer to them anyway, or the conventions, but the conventions don't apply to me in many ways. Like, I'm more likely to be the one who's complaining about how untidy it is. So.
Cliches are funny, though, aren't they? Cliches and generalizations, without them, it would be hard to have humor, I think. We have to laugh at these stereotypes.
Mm, true.
I think so. I don't know whether that's because I'm English.
I think it's part of recognizing. It can be very healing. I mean, the stereotype of the guy who can't get laid in once he gets married has been very helpful to me, to help me laugh at during those fallow periods, and recognize A, that I'm not alone, and B, that therefore there must be a deeper reason, a deeper dynamic at play here.
Yeah, and the stereotype is born out of, I guess, more than one person.
Exactly,
so you're not alone.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I think something I was reading, actually, I was rereading, trying to memorize my website before I spoke to you. Oh God, I must do some research. I must refresh my memory.
Yeah.
And someone had asked me in an interview about whether my contracts were deliberately provocative, and I'd replied that they were, but they had a base, a kind of foundation of research to them, but that humor and absurdist thought are important, you know, that we have, sometimes it's the things we laugh about we can engage with, you know, provocative things or difficult things. It's through humor that we can face them. It's like the fool, isn't it? The idea of the fool. So I think it's important to keep that sense of humor about things, which is, you know, kind of interesting now when you're not really allowed to make fun of anybody because we live in this weird time when everyone's outraged by everything.
That was just the word that Holly used. She's saying that people are in a permanent state of outrage now, which is contradictory, because if you're always outraged, then,
She must bear the brunt of it because she puts herself out there into the hornet's nest of social media and stirs that pot up, and you know, it's unforgiving, I think. It's not a platform that I really want to engage with because it's so ludicrous. And I couldn't figure out whether it's got more ridiculous or whether I just didn't notice it 10 years ago, whether people have got more sensitive on Facebook and
No,
my
of course it's escalating. Of course it is. I mean, I think it is. That's an interesting question in itself. Like, as one becomes sensitized to to culture, like you were saying earlier, to begin with, you can't even recognize it because you've been encultured so much that you just think it's normal. And as one does begin to identify the cultural implants and remove them or dissolve them, then one is more sensitive to the culture. So that is true, but at the same time, I think it's possible to objectively or semi-objectively observe that it's becoming more and more of a minefield just to speak. And it's language again. It seems as though this came up with a recent podcast, which I haven't aired yet, Susan Frey, about, and I don't know if, I think it was in regard to this, the political correctness thing, but it was to do with how we're attempting to turn everything into language, or some part of us. It's like a virus that's installed itself in our consciousness, and now it's trying to turn everything into itself. So we're trying to create a world that's completely structured in a linear fashion, like language. And part of how we can see that is that language is becoming more and more the definer of reality.
because it's written, isn't it? If you think about it, because the written word is social media. I mean, people aren't having Skype conversations, are they? It's written, and yeah, it's really strange to see it unfold like it has done, because it's definitely happening. I'm starting to see double speak and cognitive dissonance and this complete divide and conquer. And people go insane, literally. You know, everything's. I read an article about a man who, he wrote this article, and it was just about, you know, probably deliberately provocative, but saying women have historically accepted their place as secondary, haven't stepped up to the plate, and now they want everything given to them, and they want to be equal, but they should earn it. You know, it was probably a bit provocative. It was just an opinion, and preface to somebody sharing that, he had to say, in case you're triggered by this article, go to these links. And I was just thinking, oh my God, I've stepped into like the Truman Show or something. Like, we can't actually read an opinion piece now without a disclaimer. That's complete madness to me, because I don't know, I don't really want to go into it, but I will, because often me and my boyfriend talk a lot about this kind of neoliberal feminist, how they're almost, I feel like there's the driving force of censorship, that they expound this idea of, you know, inclusivity, and we can, everybody's equal and we're free speech, but as soon as you say something they don't agree with, they come down on you like a ton of bricks. And they can't believe, they can't see that free speech is free speech. Like, anything that isn't free speech, well, when there's no free speech, that's it, you know. You can't, oh sorry, I can't.
Yeah, I know. Well, I don't think that those who propagate this new ultra sensitivity to people's feelings and what you know, what caution about what you say, and so that kind of drive, I think they're less and less able to talk about free speech. I mean, consciously, I think they probably are less and less advocating free speech, because I think it's becoming overt now. The free speech is not worth the harm it could do to the snowflake people.
Yeah, and I feel like with my situation, I have a Trump card, you know, with like my dad killed my mom, and I could, you know, wear that cross for the rest of my life and slam everybody down, like, and play the victim. But you really have to choose not to, and these people are just indulging this, you know, outrage, and they, I just, it doesn't lead to a good place, does it?
No, it doesn't. So, I mean, because you brought up the victim thing, and that, I think that's very true, that snowflakeism is inseparable from the victim card, the power of the victim, and how that has become so overt now. That the one who is most offended, most vocal or expressive of their offendedness, but also who can back it up with some sort of credential, whether it's a trauma in the past, or it's whether their marginal identity they've assigned themselves is you know, threatened with persecution in the present, or both, then yeah, that's the social currency that really, you know, gives them clout. So, it's interesting what you said there, of course, that you're aware of that as somebody who has had a very traumatic experience in your past that you have memory of. I have to put that qualifier on the end, because I think we all have, but most of us don't remember. So in your case, it was this very dramatic and very traumatic event, and you're saying that the culture, or this sort of cultural context that you're in, it sounds as though you're constantly being reminded of it, in the sense of, oh, you could use that as you know, as leverage in the discussion.
I don't personally think that. I think because it happened how many years ago? 11 years ago for me. So I haven't got over it. Of course you can't get over that, but I've reconciled it and accepted it, and luckily it happened before social media. But there's something about, you have to take responsibility for your actions, and as cliched as it sounds and as boring as it sounds, everybody suffers, don't they? Sometimes I feel like people have had lesser things happen to them in their life than me that have affected them a lot more. So in a way, it's not measurable. You can't measure trauma against somebody else's. And I feel like that's what people are doing now. It's like, well, I've got this trauma. Well, I was sexually abused as a child. Well, you know, I was in a skiing accident and my leg was cut off. But we all suffer trauma. Trauma and suffering are a part of being human. So it's almost irrelevant to me to even mention it in those. I wouldn't ever mention it in those situations, because it's not relevant and it's not important, is it?
Well, I mean, no, yes and no, I suppose. But I mean, it's, what's happening now is that the context for trauma is being so trivialized, because it's being used, let's say, for simplicity's sake, by the ego in order to empower itself. I mean, that's worse than trivializing. That's actually denigrating it or exploiting it. Because I saw this with my brother, and he never played the victim card. He did the opposite of that, but he was still exploiting his own trauma, because he was he created an identity, you know, that was very glamorous and very dramatic and very decadent and all of those things, that is sort of the flip side of the victim without actually being overtly abusive. But anyway, without getting into that, because it's obviously quite difficult to talk about without talking about deeply, same with your experience, that to turn one's trauma into a kind of currency is really just self-harming, I think that would actually...
Absolutely, and it clearly, I forget what the actual therapy was that made you keep revisiting your trauma.
Reenactment compulsion, yeah.
Something like that, in order to heal you, they'd take you back to that particular time. But as from what I gathered, there was absolutely no medical or emotional value to keep revisiting it. You know, you have to transform it. You have to learn how to transcend it. And I feel like the culture at the moment is just wallowing in it. And wallowing in trauma doesn't benefit anybody.
No, that's for sure. I mean, there's a difference between re-traumatization and reenactment of trauma. So, and this, of course, I explored with Whitley in Prisoner Infinity, was that he seemed to be trapped in this compulsive traumatic, this compulsive re-traumatization. And with my brother also, because he got crucified, I mean, he was attempting at some level to clear out the trauma by reenacting it. But the danger is that you just re-traumatize and then you add trauma on top of trauma, and then that has the opposite effect. I think the idea is not to re-traumatize or necessarily consciously reenact the circumstances of trauma, but to recognize when one is being triggered by circumstances that are similar to whatever happened in the past, even if they're very superficial, and this is back to marriage and why it's a crucible, and that then that stirs up the trauma that's trapped in the body, like these very overwhelmingly powerful emotions. I just had this experience today, actually. It was, I think I can talk about it, that I did the image for Alison Miller, the podcast, and I would say now, I have to own up a bit, I unconsciously put some violent imagery there that relates to my own programming and conditioning with my mother and stuff. And anyway, Alison was, she's a therapist who works with ritual abuse survivors. She was triggered by the imagery and she got very upset and became quite forceful, let's say, and that was massively triggering for me. And so I felt really discombobulated today until it resolved. And fortunately, I was able to see two things. One, that I still have some unconscious violence, hostility towards my mother that I've written about in Seen and Not Seen, and that probably came out when I was doing the imagery. And the other thing was that to have a woman that I trust and respect and that I was hoping would be happy with the artwork I did and stuff, to actually attack me, essentially, was a reenactment. That was just how I would have felt as a child all the time with my mother. So no wonder it was destabilizing, right? But that was, I mean, that, because I was able to see that I'd been acting unconsciously and I triggered somebody to do the same, and so it brought all this stuff to the surface. That is helpful. That is cathartic, because it's like those feelings can come into consciousness in a way that doesn't reduce consciousness, you know, that doesn't, because if we get really triggered, we just react, we act out, we become less conscious. But if we're able to just hold the space for those feelings and let them come into awareness and not act out, then they get cleared out.
Thank you.
Second part of my conversation with Francis will be up at autoculture.com/liminalist. The following Wednesday, 22nd of March, 2017, we will be in springtime by then. Incredible, really. What time does without a pair of wings? I'm going to thank some donators over the past couple of weeks. Most of you are regular donators, so it really is you that are keeping the engine fired. Kelvin, Steve, Holly, Sivatslav, Andy, Samuel, Chris, and Glenn. Much appreciated. Always is. And the next week's podcast, unless I'm very much mistaken, is with the actor and film director Keith Gordon. Till then, liminalizing over into this song, whatever it is. Bye.